Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Whitney Phillips, a digital media folklorist who has spent a decade exploring trolling, hate, and misogyny online, online ethics, and folkloric ambivalence across media, an incoming professor in the Communication and Rhetorical Studies Department at Syracuse University. She is the author of This Is the Way We Can't Have Nice Things, Mapping the Relationship Between Online Trolling and Mainstream Culture. And she's the co-author of The Ambivalent Internet, Mischief, Oddity, and Antagonism Online. And her latest article at The Guardian is How Journalists Should Not Cover an Online Conspiracy Theory. Welcome to Background Briefing, Whitney Phillips.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us, Whitney. And just before we get into your article at The Guardian, How Journalists Should Not Cover an Online Conspiracy Theory, a new public opinion survey conducted by Ipsos has just revealed that 43% of Republicans want to give Trump the power to shut down media that they don't agree with. So apparently Trump's demonizing of the media, or particularly the New York Times, CNN, The Washington Post, and MSNBC, as the enemy of the people, is working.
Well, yeah, and that's what makes fact-checking efforts and media traditional media literacy efforts so difficult, that under perfect conditions, if there were a false narrative that were circulating social media, all media companies would need to do is say, this is false. Their QAnon is not a real thing. This conspiracy does not exist. You don't need to be worried about it. And that would take care of the problem, that that information would be corrective of false belief. But as it is, there is such a profound mistrust of mainstream news organizations that in some circles, simply by fact-checking a story, by debunking a particular story, that could reaffirm or further entrench that idea in the minds of someone who automatically believes that everything the New York Times reports is a lie. So that makes media literacy efforts that much more complicated.
But we are no longer a country where there is a consensus on what is real and what is true. Arguably, during the days of Walter Cronkite, when Uncle Walter delivered the news, there was a kind of consensus across the country. But since then, what seems to have happened is a kind of form of what they call reality shopping, where liberals get their information from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox, Christians from Christian Broadcasting. And this has had the effect of kind of balkanizing reality, if you like.
It has, yes. I mean, so one of the most profound shifts in the last generation, really, is the shift from singular media information gatekeepers to countless gatekeepers. You know, that it's not just that you have different realities being shopped by the likes of MSNBC or Fox News or whatever. What happens, you have a more complex feedback loop where you've got, you know, speaking of far-right extremists, you've got far-right extremists kind of kicking about certain ideas in these far fringe corners of the internet, but that bubbles up through Breitbart, and then what bubbles up through Breitbart filters in through Fox News and then sometimes gets tweeted about by the president, and that just entrenches that whole cycle. So you have multiple entry points for information, and then once that information enters a particular filter bubble, it can be very difficult to decouple or to challenge information that's not true, because it's kind of just bouncing around and becoming ever stronger the more times people share a particular idea.
Well, it seems that particularly these conspiracy theories, they don't really fall into any particular political category, because you have the left-wing media like this network, Pacifica, which promoted the 9/11 truther conspiracy with a film called Loose Change that was produced by none other than Alex Jones. And then you have right-wing media like Fox propagating the birther conspiracy.
Well, I mean, I would say that the current conspiracies that are being kicked around on social media, and particularly the QAnon conspiracy, that sort of began in these far-right corners, and then it enters. What is interesting about the filter bubble theory is that explains things up to a point. But after that point, it becomes more complicated, because even when you have sort of far-right fringe perspectives, wherever they might fall on the ideological spectrum, once they start getting reported by mainstream organizations, then that's when the ideas really become highly visible and prominent. One of the One of the things that I discovered in research recently published by Data and Society, a research institute in New York City, is that it wasn't so much that you had a lot of content sort of mimetic play. It wasn't just that trolls and the quote-unquote alt-right, it wasn't just that they were pushing ideology into the mainstream. It was that mainstream journalists were repeating it. And it really got its strength from what is, well, depending on your perspective, I guess, these days, but more sort of center-left, centrist, mainstream organizations, that's where a lot of these ideas actually get their most, certainly their largest platform, and is where they become strongest. It's actually from the center, not from the fringes, as you might expect.
Well, I think the one thing in common on the fringes of both the left and the right in terms of conspiracy is a alienation from the government itself. And I always find that extraordinary. It may be connected to the fact that the world's most enduring democracy has about the lowest voting participation of all of the advanced democracies. And is that an explanation or a partial explanation? Alienation?
Although, you know, one of the most sort of puzzling analyses to come out of far-right conspiracies is that the Republican Party, the right wing, controls everything. So typically when you have conspiracies, yeah, it comes from the fringe, it comes from sort of variously underrepresented groups, at least ideologically underrepresented groups, and so people are sort of expressing their frustration by not being in positions of power, by, you know, sort of adhering to particular reality-affirming narratives that, you know, that make sense to them and that sort of help explain the world. And generally speaking, that's from people who are on the edges of the machine. But you have these, you especially with the sort of deep state conspiracy theories, that's coming from the ultimate seat of power. So that's, conspiracies have always existed and they typically have operated on the fringe. It's unusual and unique, and the people who study conspiracies in the U.S. in particular have commented on how unusual it is that the winning party is actually propagating some of these conspiracies, because that's just typically not how the pattern works.
And again, I'm speaking with Whitney Phillips, a digital media folklorist who has spent a decade exploring trolling, hate, and misogyny online, online ethics, and folkloric ambivalence across media, an incoming professor in the Communication and Rhetorical Studies Department at Syracuse University. She's the author of This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, Mapping the Relationship Between Online Trolling and Mainstream Culture. And she's the co-author of The Ambivalent Internet, Mischief, Oddity, and Antagonism Online. And her latest article at The Guardian is How Journalists Should Not Cover an Online Conspiracy Theory. Well, I think to buttress the point that you just made, Whitney, it is, after all, the myth of the liberal media was something that the Republicans invented and they've been pounding on for decades, and it's obviously become a kind of touchstone of truth in those circles. And then, of course, the Christian right that has undue political influence in this country, they nevertheless portray themselves as beleaguered martyrs fighting a losing battle against secularism, etc., and the moral degradation of America, even though at this point they support a libertine president who lies prolifically and apparently pays off porn stars.
It's the human creature is quite an interesting creature indeed.
So let's focus on your article at The Guardian, How Journalists Should Not Cover an Online Conspiracy Theory. You say here that there's a symbiotic relationship between participating trolls and the news media, the fact that trolls need journalists to amplify their attacks, and that some journalists need trolls to give them sensational things to write about. Is that the sort of toxic compact that we're talking about here that propels this sort of rash of malign? I mean, the most extraordinary thing, again, I hate to keep talking about Trump, but here in California, you know, I can barely breathe the air in Los Angeles because of fires. Northern California is entirely on fire. And our president says it's to do with Governor Brown's water policies, where he lets all the water go into the Pacific Ocean and the firefighters don't have any water to put out the fires, which, of course, is ludicrously untrue. So I don't know where to begin. So let's touch on what you've posed here in your article about a symbiosis between trolls and journalists.
Well, I mean, yeah, and you could also talk about the symbiosis between journalists and Trump himself, although that's sort of a separate conversation, but not really. But one of the, so a pattern that I noticed when I started this work in 2008, which feels like 300 years ago, given everything that's happened, especially in the last few years, what was very striking and what I was actually studying was this relationship between these trolls who were deliberately trying to inflict emotional distress and cause the greatest sort of scandalous response as possible, and then journalists who covered them. So although I was studying trolls, I was actually studying that relationship between journalists and trolls, because both journalists and trolls ended up benefiting from trolls' misbehavior. Trolls benefited because they amassed what they refer to as lulls, which is a particular sort of antagonistic humor, indicating that the target has responded negatively, so that makes them laugh in a particular way. And journalists benefited because they would get advertising revenue and additional readers. I mean, for the last 10 years, you throw the word troll in a headline, and that almost guarantees you're going to get a lot of engagement. And so there's been some incentivization of continuing to write about trolls, and then, of course, trolls continuing to behave badly because all of their behaviors have proven to be so successful over time. So that was something that I established 10 years ago. And the troll space, as I have referred to it, it has changed considerably. The trolls that I was studying, they were definitely antagonistic, and they behaved in all kinds of, you know, racist and misogynistic and very problematic ways. But they didn't, they actually really rejected the idea of having a clear politics. So if somebody actually declared that they were far right or far left or anything, that would be grounds for that troll to be trolled by other trolls. And so trolls were not political in any kind of traditional way. They were privileged in their behavior, and it was politicized for sure, but they didn't declare themselves as being a member of a particular ideology. Over time, especially around 2015, there was a shift within those same spaces. More and more actual white nationalists who very proudly, you know, proclaimed an ideology, they started occupying those spaces. And so the troll space 4chan of 2008 is a very, very, very different place than where it is now. But those same rhetorical strategies and the same attempts to trick journalists into repeating a particular narrative or amplifying a story, the participants may have changed and their ideology may have changed, but those strategies have remained absolutely 100% constant for the last 10 years and even before that, because trolls were doing this several years before I started researching them. And so now, you know, you basically, it's watching the same story unfold over and over and over and over again, literally in my own perspective, in my own experience, for a decade. The same behaviors, the same coordinated manipulation strategies result in the same kind of coverage. And so, of course, they keep doing it because it keeps getting the attention that they want. And so you can't draw a very clear line between, you know, what happened on 4chan in 2008, but you really can look at these patterns and say, man, we need to start responding differently, because we just keep giving these manipulators and abusers exactly what they want and need, which is coverage and a national platform.
Well, you could make the case that Donald Trump is the ultimate troll. I mean, first of all, to address what you said earlier, the mainstream media gave Donald Trump about $5 billion worth of free advertising, which is probably why he won, if indeed you accept the idea that he won the presidential election, and the stuff that he tweets out on a daily basis. And also, his rallies have now become a focal point for people like QAnon to make themselves visible.
Yeah, that's a complicated... So over time, the word troll, when I was first researching this space, 4chan in particular, troll meant something very specific. It was a subcultural point of self-identification. That trolling was, it wasn't just what someone did online, it was who they believed themselves to be. It was an identity. And starting around 2010, 2011, internet culture, meme culture became more and more popular as a commodity. So you started seeing more and more advertisers employing trolling jokes and trolling references and trolling memes. And also the greater public became more and more exposed to and interested in trolling content. And so trolling kind of it became diluted as a subcultural concept. And then journalists started using the word troll to describe more and more different kinds of behaviors until the word troll became really muddled. And back in 2008, if you said the word troll, it meant something very specific. Now, if you use the word troll, it could mean anything from being a Nazi or identifying with white supremacist ideology all the way to sort of teasing your friend in a harmless kind of a way. And I think there's a danger in collapsing those different behavioral categories because, for one thing, it's imprecise. And for another thing, it seems it accidentally equates violently bigoted antagonisms with, you know, play and humor, and we need to be able to differentiate those things because they warrant different responses. As it relates to Trump, I have really gone out of my way to not just avoid calling him a troll, but to really push back against that framing, because part of the problem with trolling is that it has this connotation of being somehow playful, that it's something that someone is doing on the internet, but it doesn't really have real-world consequences. And Trump may be outrageous, and he absolutely employs trollish rhetoric to gain the greatest amount of attention that he can. But what he does and what he says has profound embodied impact on countless groups of countless individuals and groups of people. And so by referring to it as trolling, I think it might take away some of the teeth of the impact of what he does, and focusing on the bodies that are impacted, I think is really important and is sometimes lost when you use this word that has, you know, historically this connotation of sort of, we don't have to take it that seriously. Trump says all kinds of things, but what he says and what he does could not be more impactful in everyday people's lives, and I think it's really important to keep that in mind.
Well, I would think that trolls, going back to the kind of grim fairy tale idea of these creatures living under bridges, is they may be playful, but they're also scary, and I think it's the scary part that seems to be dominating. Just in closing, Apple, Google, Facebook, and Spotify have curtailed the influence of Alex Jones and his InfoWars content online. But at the same time, could you make the case that these giant tech billionaires in the Silicon Valley, who are the exemplars of the growing income disparity in this country, are they sort of heralding in a new kind of feudalism where content creators are like jesters in the court of King Zuckerberg?
Well, I've been highly critical of Facebook forever, and I think that the Alex Jones case, it gets confused, especially when people start, you know, bringing in conversations about free speech and different issues of censorship. All of those issues are important, and you know, there's all kinds of risks involved and the slippery slope of who gets to decide who stays and who goes and who watches the watchers and all of that. But I think that the Alex Jones question, it also is a question of capitalism, that at a certain point he was relevant, or that was something that Facebook and Apple and Spotify, that was worth something to them. To keep him on the site, it was worth more to keep him there than to get rid of him. At a certain point, he became an economic liability to them. And so, yes, we need to have conversations about free speech and about censorship and all of these different kinds of things, but this idea that we're talking about capitalism, we're talking about corporations who make decisions not based out of morality, and Zuckerberg can say whatever he wants about free speech, that's fine, but they're making corporate decisions and they're also making legal-based decisions. They want to minimize their risk and maximize their profit, and so that is going to dictate, or at least strongly influence, the kinds of decisions they make around people like Alex Jones, which is not, you know, that's not heartening or anything like that, but it's also important to keep an eye on the corporate element of these conversations, which sometimes fall away when the focus is just on censorship and free speech issues.
Well, Whitney Phillips, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Whitney Phillips, who's a digital media folklorist who has spent a decade exploring trolling, hate, and misogyny online, online ethics and folkloric ambivalence across media, an incoming professor in the Communication and Rhetorical Studies Department at Syracuse University. She's the author of This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, Mapping the Relationship Between Online Trolling and Mainstream Culture. And she's the co-author of The Ambivalent Internet, Mischief, Oddity, and Antagonism Online. And the latest article at The Guardian is How Journalists Should Not Cover an Online Conspiracy Theory. We're going to take a brief station break And we'll be back to discuss Trump's idiotic tweets blaming the California wildfires on Governor Brown